Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
This is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. I'm joined today by Mary Kate Lizotte, who is the author of Gender Differences in Political Opinion, Values, and Political Consequences. This book was published in 2020 by Temple University Press and is a really timely analysis of understanding what we think about as the gender gap and how this applies with regard to the choices that voters make, be they men or women, and how they come to some of their conclusions with regard to those vote choices. But I'm going to let Mary Kate tell us a little bit about that, as well as who she is and how she came to this particular project. Thanks for joining me today, Mary Kate.
Thank you for having me. So I have been interested in politics for a very long time. I was a strange child to watch the presidential debates with their parents. And I remember being really interested in the 1992 presidential debate, mostly because I was under the impression that my parents were going to vote for different candidates. And I was astonished by that. So I've been interested in politics for a very long time and interested in the gender gap since graduate school. My dissertation was on gender differences in support for military action. And so when thinking about writing a book and the research that I had done up until the book since my dissertation, I had looked at a lot of different public opinion gaps. And I had also looked at some gender differences in voting and political knowledge and some other things. And I really wanted to try to take this more singular approach to the gender gap in public opinion and see if values in particular could help to explain a number of gaps rather than some of the more piecemeal research that I and others have done, where you look at a single gender gap in one area of public opinion. I wanted to look at many different public opinion gaps and get a sense of whether or not there was an overarching explanation that could help us understand more than one gap at a time.
And you do a really nice job of sort of going through that in the book. It's really clearly laid out. But I want to first talk about this concept, the gender gap, which we can read about in lots of different places and is always something that is discussed, as you note, particularly during presidential election years. Can you first sort of explain this concept and also how your research kind of unpacked it?
Sure. So the gender gap is a term that the news media really started to coin in response to the 1980 presidential election exit polls, where women had been more likely to vote for President Carter than Reagan. And it's all about the fact that men and women have these slight differences in their vote choice, in their voter turnout, in their public opinions, all these different things, political ideology, party identification. And usually the gender gap is calculated or thought of as the difference between men and women. Oftentimes in political science research and also in the news media, it's discussed as the difference between men and women's likelihood of voting for the Democratic presidential candidate. And so it has ranged from like 4 percentage points to 12 percentage points, depending on the election. And the same is true for public opinion gaps, where women are slightly more likely to vote for Democratic presidential candidates, between 4 and 12 percentage points. And then on various issues, there are similarly sized gaps. So women tend to be more liberal on a number of issues, including support for defense spending, support for environmental protections, support for social safety net programs, and other things like that. And so the gap is that percentage point difference between men and women's support for either a candidate or a position on a particular policy area.
And in this book, in particular, you are trying to thread together, as you note, sort of looking at this not in a piecemeal way, but in a broader, more integrative way. And you bring together four particular issue umbrellas. I'd hesitate to say they were just particular issue areas, but umbrella sections, to try to understand if there is this sort of broad gender gap. Can you talk about how you came to these four sort of issue umbrella areas as a way of looking at this particular sort of political behavior discussion?
Sure. Well, some of these are pretty well established in terms of being the more sizable gap. So I look at the use of force, both internationally, meaning defense spending, military action, as well as domestically, meaning death penalty and gun control issues. I also look at environmental issues. I look at social welfare programs. And I also look at attitudes towards equal rights for different historically marginalized groups. And for each of those issue areas, there's been some established work showing that there is a gender gap. There are other issue areas where there's a gender gap, but there's also issues where there's not really much of a gender gap, such as on abortion attitudes. And so I chose to look at the issues that I knew had been established as having gender differences on them.
And you said also that you sort of had come into some of this discussion from your doctoral work on military action and gender differences, which is also the first case study in the text. Can you talk about why, in particular, you've seen and other scholars and researchers have seen this kind of broader gap in that area?
Sure. That's one of the largest. It tends to be the largest gender gap on support for the use of force internationally. So in particular, committing troops to military action. And there's a lot of explanations out there as to why it is that women are less supportive of committing troops. Some research indicates that women are more sensitive to the loss of life, to casualties during war. And that can extend to both military and non-military casualties. There's some research to indicate that women are less risk acceptant, meaning that they're risk averse to the idea that military action could lead to negative consequences, so could lead to retaliation or something of that nature. But there's also some really interesting work that shows that women are not always against military action. At times, particularly if there's a humanitarian crisis or if there is wide support and international cooperation, such as the United Nations, behind a particular military action, then women can be brought on board in favor of committing troops or in favor of some sort of action in that way. But it really varies a lot. And my research is focused on American politics and American gender differences. And a lot of these gaps don't necessarily apply to other countries, but the military action gap does appear to often emerge in other countries as well.
And in terms of the gap itself, in terms of the use of force umbrella, what is the gap, and does it sort of shrink, as you say, if there's international support or broad-based support, does that move the gap to be smaller in particular instances?
So it can actually shrink the gap. And in some research using fictional reasons for committing troops, we actually see a reversal of the gap, meaning that women become more supportive of trying to intervene when it comes to a humanitarian crisis or when there's international cooperation like the United Nations is involved. So with real life circumstances, such as intervening in Rwanda or other instances of humanitarian crisis, we see a much smaller gap, around 2 to 4 percentage points. Whereas in other situations that don't involve humanitarian crisis, the gap gets up around 12 to 14 percentage points at times with real life situations. But with fictional situations, we've actually seen the gap can reverse in direction, which is, you know, pretty fascinating.
And so in order to sort of take you through each of the case studies, the next one you look at is environmental policy. And can you explain a little bit about why this particular issue area, which sometimes gets a lot of attention and sometimes gets almost no attention, is one that also seems to have a bit of a gender gap?
So in my book, my argument is that when women think about environmental issues, they think about the consequences of not protecting the environment and the consequences that that will have for their own, you know, families and friends, but also, you know, more largely on people in terms of, you know, climate change causing mass migration or food shortages or that sort of thing. And so in my mind, the gap on environmental issues comes about because of women's tendency to think about how, you know, other people are going to deal with various situations and making sure that everyone has a safe, you know, life. So others have done some research on the gender gap in environmental attitudes, but it's been a less looked at gap in comparison to the other ones that I explore in the book. There was some older research from the 1990s looking at feminism and attitudes towards the environment. But generally, much of the other research on the gender gap on environmental attitudes has just noted that there's a difference, but hasn't really explored so much as to why that difference exists, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to look at it. And then, you know, given the partisan discussions about climate change, that being a looming issue, I definitely wanted to include environmental issues in the book for that reason as well.
The next one you look at are sort of an umbrella of social issues. So my first question is to sort of tease out what those issues generally are or policy areas are, and if there are distinctions within the particular sort of silos of those issues as well.
Sure. So I look at a number of social welfare questions. So things such as, you know, do you prefer that the government provide more or fewer services? So just a general overview of someone's belief about how activist a government should be. And then there's specific questions in terms of support for increased spending on welfare, food stamps, aid to help the homeless, aid to help the poor. There's a question on health insurance or healthcare and to what extent the government should be involved in that. And then there's also questions about spending, government spending on childcare, public schools, and Social Security. So all of these different measures have been used in past research by others to look at women's and men's attitudes towards social welfare programs. And they are often lumped together into a single scale. I look at them mostly separately, but also as a scale because they are pretty different. I mean, you know, support for public school spending, you would think, would be fairly different from support for spending to help the homeless. But I actually find, as have others, that generally women are more supportive of more government spending, or at least maintaining current levels of spending in comparison to men, who are less likely to want to increase or maintain and more likely to want to decrease government spending. And there just seems to be this general difference where women see government as potentially a means to help solve these sorts of public problems or public issues, and men are more likely to want less government than more government.
And the final case study that you look at is this question of issues around equality, which again is kind of an umbrella. So if you can unpack the pieces of that umbrella and talk a little bit about what you also found with regard to the gender gap here.
Sure. So I look at attitudes towards gay rights. I look at attitudes towards affirmative action. I look at a measure of racial attitudes called racial resentment that's pretty well established in political science. And then finally, I look at support for gender equality. And for each of those issue areas, I find that women are more positive towards these different marginalized groups, as well as more supportive of equal rights for these different marginalized groups. The findings are strongest for the questions asking about gay rights. So those questions ask about whether or not gay marriage should be legal, whether or not gays and lesbians should be able to serve openly in the military, whether or not they should be able to adopt children, and whether or not there should be government protections against discrimination for employment for gay and lesbian individuals. And I find the largest gender gap on those items. But there are gender differences where women are less likely to have racially resentful attitudes towards African Americans, and they're more supportive of affirmative action type policies in comparison to men. And women are more supportive of gender equality than men in general.
And so in all four of these issue areas, you talk about and sort of driving the sort of analysis in the book. The question of values, which is also the subtitle of the book, Values and Political Consequences. And this is your sort of developed theory to think about the overarching explanation for gender gaps. Can you explain a little bit about how you sort of define this question of value difference, and also what you found in applying this theory to these particular case studies?
Sure. So basically, because of some data limitations, I look specifically at pro-social values, this idea that women, for whatever reason, whether it be because of socialization or other reasons, are slightly more likely to care about others and to have this belief that other people should be protected and be safe and be treated equally, that those sorts of beliefs end up influencing how they view these different policy areas. And when it comes to values differences, just like when it comes to the gender gaps, I wasn't expecting to find huge differences. I wasn't expecting to find that, you know, 90% of women have these pro-social values where they care about other people, where, you know, only 10% of men feel that way. I was looking for these small differences where men and women overlap to a great degree, in that, you know, many men, just like women, view the world through this lens of caring what happens to other people and wanting to ensure that people are treated well and that they're treated equally. So I use mostly a measure of what's called egalitarianism, this support for societal and individual equality. And I find that it does help to illuminate why some of these gender gaps exist. The findings are pretty strong. They're stronger for some of the issue areas than for others. So this idea that women think about others' well-being and how different policies could negatively or positively affect other people appears to help us to understand why it is that women are less supportive of the death penalty and more supportive of environmental protections. I would say that the least strong findings are for the military issue area, but generally this view of the world, this belief that protecting other people's well-being, ensuring that people are treated well, helps us to understand particularly the equal rights issues as well as the social welfare issues.
And so in terms of having an overarching theory and understanding of the gender gap, as you note, you saw some differences within issue areas themselves, and you highlight some of this with regard to questions of use of force, combat troops on the ground versus, say, defense spending. Can you explain a little bit about some of the places where you saw some of this tension?
Sure. So I think that for certain issue areas, the questions that I look at just seem more closely aligned to one another. And so it makes sense that the same explanation would work for similar questions. I think for defense spending and for military action, it becomes really complicated when thinking about pro-social values and how that might apply, because you could see how perhaps some people would see increased defense spending as a way of protecting people, a way of ensuring the well-being of others. But you could also see others, other individuals, look at defense spending as taking, say, funding away from social welfare programs, or you know, being a detriment to helping people and ensuring equality. So I think that that's part of the reason why there's some more difficulty with those particular questions. And I also think that the question of the military in the abstract is a difficult one for people to answer. Defense spending, less so. But when it comes to this idea of, you know, should we use military action versus should we use diplomacy, which is the general question that I look at, it's a hypothetical question. And I think it really depends on the circumstances in the situation. And so it's a little bit more difficult to ask people that question and to really, you know, figure out what's going on there. I think for particular military situations, it would perhaps be a little bit easier to unpack what's going on and to figure out. But with hypothetical situations like that, I think it's a little bit difficult because people are going to vary so much in terms of what they support, depending on what the, you know, external circumstances are.
And you talk about this also in terms of the question of policy areas around equality, that you saw some differences and some tensions in that area, as you noted, with regard to very strong support around the LGBTQ community, and then some of the other sort of policy areas. Can you talk a little bit about why that particular area may also include some of these tensions?
Sure. I think part of it has to do with some data limitation issues. For the affirmative action question, it does actually talk about affirmative action for African Americans, but I think for a lot of women, when they think about affirmative action, they can't help but think about other groups as well, including themselves benefiting from it. So I think in some ways that can be a difficult thing to look at because of what comes to mind when asked that question. I also think that racial attitudes are really complicated. Obviously, white women have a lot of privilege. And as we've seen in recent elections, there is this, you know, tension between women who might want to support a female candidate or support a candidate who is for policies that would benefit women, but at the same time, that, you know, white privilege can get in the way. So I think that that create some messiness there in trying to disentangle what's going on. Unfortunately, the data didn't include great questions to look at policy positions on racial issues so much. There's really only the affirmative action and the racial resentment scale, which is unfortunate. There's some other questions that are just incredibly problematic. And so I didn't even want to look at them. But I think with the LGBTQ questions, you know, that's been a more salient issue as of late. And I think that that has just been, for some reason, more cut and dry for a lot of people in terms of the way that they think about those issues. Whereas perhaps some of the racial and gender equality issues have more sort of historical baggage for people. And so I think that that might be producing some of the tensions with the results and the fact that it's just easier to see LGBTQ rights in this sort of more modern light, rather than this, you know, historically weighed down view that people might have of gender equality and racial equality issues, but I'm not entirely sure, to be honest.
And just so everybody knows, can you talk a little bit about where you got the data? Because it's important to your research, and it's a sort of broad data sort of category.
Sure. So I use the American National Election Study data, their cumulative data set from 1980 until 2012. And then I also use some additional American National Election Study data from 2016 to look at some more recent issues like marriage equality and climate change. But that data is NSF funded. It's been collected for a very long time, since the late 60s, early 70s. It's publicly available data, and they collect a cross section of Americans. They question them every presidential election year. They take a sample and talk to around 2,000 people, sometimes more, sometimes less, before the presidential election takes place, and then also after the presidential election takes place. And a subset of that data that's collected every presidential election year and sometimes midterm election year is asked the same subset of questions every single time the survey is put forth, and all of that data across all of those years is then combined into this one data set. And so I control for the type of presidential administration in the analysis, whether or not there's a Republican president in the White House, to try to get at this, you know, issue of there being a long number of years that the data is collected across. But that's, you know, is really exciting that the same questions are being asked over and over again. But at the same time, it creates certain limitations because certain questions, you know, have never been asked or were asked in a somewhat problematic way now that we look back on it. But you're sort of stuck with the way that it was worded, you know, 20 years ago or more so.
And again, this is, I mean, I've looked at it. Many political scientists have looked at the data for whatever reasons. So it's a substantial data set, but as you note, it also has its limitations. And I wanted to ask you the sort of broader question that I have in sort of exploring the questions of the gender gap and the policy areas that you look at. And this is what you talk about also in the conclusion, that there, as you note, gender differences in public opinion significantly contribute to the gender gap in party ID. And I'd really love to hear about how we should think about gender differences, the gender gap, and particularly party identification.
Sure. Well, I think that, you know, we've seen for a long time in the political science research and obviously with the news coverage of various presidential elections that women tend to vote for Democratic candidates. And a lot of that is because women are more likely to identify as Democrats. And there's a lot of really exciting research out there as to why and when that started to occur. A lot of that research I haven't conducted, but others have looked at how changes in the South with the, you know, modern Republican Party merging with the religious right, and how that influenced the party identification of women versus men. But my interest was in looking at how gender differences in policy positions actually contributes to partisanship and that partisan gender gap. So the fact that women are more likely to identify as Democrats and to vote for Democratic candidates because the Democratic Party better aligns with their own issue positions. And so, you know, women see the Democratic Party as being similar to themselves when it comes to funding for public schools, funding to help the poor, funding to protect the environment, wanting to, limit defense spending rather than increase it, those sorts of policy positions, as well as the Democratic Party being seen as the party that champions the rights of the historically marginalized. And so, although there's a lot of great research out there looking at, who is more likely to identify as a Democrat or Republican, and, who independents are and all of those sorts of things, I really wanted to get down to how people's issue positions, their policy positions end up predicting how they identify in terms of being a Democrat or Republican.
And in that regard, what did you find as the connection between the gender differences in public opinion, as you know, with regard to sort of the Democratic Party, but also with regard to the flip side of that being that, there's a lot of discussion of how men left the Democratic Party over the course of a number of years, whereas women kind of remained in the Democratic Party because of issue saliency.
Right. So I find that a number of the issues that I look at in the previous chapters of the book contribute to the gender gap and why it is that women identify as Democrats and men are less likely to do so. In particular, defense spending, environmental policies, the equal rights policies, and the biggest reason, according to my analysis, appears to be the social welfare issues. So the government spending to help the poor on public schools, government involvement in providing health care and more services. That seems to be the number one reason why women are more likely to identify as Democrats, whereas men are, less likely to do so. So I would really argue that women are generally looking for the government to provide this social safety net. And that's one of the reasons why, women have stayed with the Democratic Party, why there's that gender gap in identification, whereas men, are less likely to look to government to provide those sorts of programs and services.
And in your research, and I know a lot of this, as you say, some of it was not exactly what you expected in terms of finding some of these gaps. What was the most sort of surprising outcome that you found as you were going through this research?
I would say one of the more surprising findings had to do with the fact that the social safety net was so important. I think that was a little bit surprising given that it doesn't always get a lot of attention. I think right now it is getting a lot of attention in terms of, the government providing services and support for its citizens. But generally, a lot of times during elections, when people are paying the most attention to politics, we're often talking about other issues such as foreign policy, or we see the candidates talking about issues of foreign policy rather than of social welfare programs. So I was a little bit surprised by that. I was also surprised, and I haven't talked about this yet here, but I look at a couple of other explanations in comparison to the values explanation. I look at whether or not motherhood helps us to understand some of these gender gaps, and the evidence is really mixed for parenthood and motherhood. It's significant in a few of the models, but not that many. Same thing with economic status. So I looked at that as a possible explanation, the fact that women are more likely to have a lower socioeconomic status. That's not a great predictor. But I was surprised by the fact that the measure that I use for feminist identity, which is limited in a lot of ways, was actually a really great predictor of a lot of these gender gaps. And so there's some old research suggesting that we shouldn't call it the gender gap, we should call it the feminist gap. And I was surprised to find some support for that. I still think the values explanation does a better job, but I don't necessarily think that they're mutually exclusive. It's very likely that feminists would rate highly on pro-social values, that they care a lot about equality and protecting the well-being of others. And so I think that that's interesting because we don't necessarily talk about feminism or feminist identity a lot up until the recent 2016 presidential election, when I think it started to gain a little bit more attention and traction again. But that was definitely one of the major surprising findings to find so much support for that alternative explanation.
And in terms of sort of casting a broader theoretical framework around this, one of the ways that you are also discussing the social safety net is as that, a social safety net, which is not necessarily what we hear politicians when they're running for office talk about policies in that broad umbrella. They may speak specifically, say, about healthcare policy recently, or, you know, reforms to Social Security, but they don't broadly speak about a social safety net, whereas we often hear broad discussions of, say, lowering or raising taxes. Can you talk a little bit about how those frames also contribute potentially to some of the possibly difficulties in the data?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that, in the American context, we often don't see a discussion of a broad social safety net. We see certain particular domestic policies become salient during an election where it gets a lot of attention, but not this overarching idea. And I do think that that's a difficulty in the data because there are these general questions, like I mentioned before, this, you know, general question about whether or not you support more government services or less. There's also a question about whether or not you think the government should do more to guarantee a certain standard of living for all Americans. And I think those sorts of questions, although they might not have been part of the, you know, larger political discourse that we see in elections, that I think that they are tapping into something very real among Americans and how they view the role of government and, you know, whether or not government should ensure that, you know, in general, people are not, you know, suffering or destitute. But it is a problem with the data that it doesn't actually, you know, get at that issue in a more specific way.
And so given the broad sort of discussion of both data and gender and sort of value theories, Mary Kate, what are you working on now?
I have a number of projects that I'm working on now. I'm doing some work with a couple of co-authors, Richard Eichenberg and Richard Stoll, on gender differences in foreign policy attitudes. So we just had a piece published on support for gender equality policy as part of a foreign policy package. So the idea that the American government would want to promote gender equality worldwide and pursue policies that do that, and whether or not there's a lot of support among American citizens for that. And we find that women are more likely to support those types of policies in the foreign policy arena. I'm also working on some other things, including trying to understand party polarization and how gender may help us to understand political and party polarization in a more nuanced way. So that work with Heather Anderson is really interesting, and we actually find, surprisingly to us, that women are a little bit more politically polarized than men, which you might, think is a little bit strange, because we think of women as being, compromising and coming together, but they actually tend to have more positive views of their in-party and more negative views of their out-party. And so by our measure, they're more politically polarized. And we use a measure that's well-established. And then I have a number of other projects. I'm interested in the gender gap on immigration attitudes and immigration policy because of the fact that that has become salient in the 2016 election and during the Trump administration. And I'm looking forward to data becoming available to look at gender differences in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. The polls right now look as though women are more likely than men to want to stay at home and social distance, that they're more likely to be afraid that states will open up too quickly. And so I'm interested in trying to, look at that and figure out why that is, that men are much more likely to be concerned about the economy, while women are more likely to be concerned about opening up too early.
And so if any of these become a book, will you come back on the New Books Network and talk to me about them?
Oh, definitely. I would love to. the foreign policy stuff with Eichenberg and Stoll, we've, talked about potentially writing a book. We have this really interesting data set, and we have some other projects that we're interested in doing with that data to try to understand, kind of going back to my, initial dissertation roots, to try to understand why there's a gender gap in foreign policy attitudes more generally. So yeah, hopefully that will in fact turn into a book. That's the plan right now, but we're at the very early stages. But yeah, I would love to definitely come back and talk more about it.
Well, I would like to learn more about it from you and your co-authors. So I look forward to reading that book when it comes out and talking to you and your co-authors about it.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you for joining me today, Mary Kate Lizotte, author of Gender Differences in Public Opinion, Values, and Political Consequences. This is published by Temple University Press in 2020 and is available at the Temple University Press website and whatever other online retailers you might want to buy a book from. Is that correct?
Yes, as far as I know.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Mary Kate.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.